This podcast may contain adult language and situations, graphic, gory details, and other not so nice things. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Ashley.
I'm Lacey, and this is United States of Murder. This week, we're in Rhode Island discussing a mysterious death that could be a murder or an accident.
Then we'll talk about the Warwick Slasher. So buckle up and join us on this dark and twisted ride through the Ocean State.
Sean O'Brien was born on December 5th, 1971, and grew up in the Providence, Rhode Island area. He was the son of Ellen and Raymond O'Brien and was especially close with his mother. He dropped out of school in eighth grade and entered the workforce. He became a talented contractor working for Artisani & Sons Roofing Company and Marshall Building Products. Sean had his daughter, Natalia, when he was 21 years old, but he and her mother, Amy, split up when she was just two. And after this, Natalia lived with her mom, Amy, and her grandmother and wasn't back in Sean's life until she was 9 years old. But they did reconnect. And they had a delayed father-daughter relationship, but they grew super close. Sean showed Natalia how to play baseball, and they would watch Red Sox games together. Sean was known as a jokester. He loved making people laugh. He loved dancing in the car, and he liked the attention. You know, he liked people to look over and see him being goofy. He was a fun-loving guy who loved to party and have a good time, but that got him into trouble sometimes. He had DUIs and a drug possession charge for cocaine. Somehow, though, he got off with just a slap of the wrist. His family said he had good luck. In July of 2006, Sean was 34 years old, working as a carpenter and living in Cranston with a roommate named Armand. So it was a duplex and there was a basement. Sean had the basement apartment of the house.
Okay.
So Armand lived upstairs and Sean lived downstairs. On the 21st, he planned to go to a local festival with Natalia, but she ended up having a headache, so there was a change of plans. They didn't end up going. He didn't want to go back home, though, because Armand was there with his girlfriend, Lynn, and he was not a big fan of Lynn. He told Amy that she had threatened him before, and there was a lot of tension there, and Amy knew about this. So he asked if she would drop him off at a local bar called Billy's Frosted Mug.
That sounds like the bar from The Simpsons.
It does. I feel like there's a big marquee of a mug going back and forth, Nashville, Broadway style. I don't know. He had recently quit drinking, but he said he wanted to go there and play some Keno. He left the car. Before he left the car, he called his sister Erin on Amy's cell, but he couldn't get a hold of her. He walked into the bar around 7 p.m. He had to get up early for work the next day, so he told Amy he probably wouldn't be out too late. Even though they weren't in a relationship anymore, they shared parenting of Natalia, but they were still super close, and they considered each other companions.
I get it.
So it's not like boyfriend-girlfriend, but it's not... It's just one. I guess it would be the it's complicated they're, on Facebook, you know.
Yeah, they're great
still
friends.
Very close. Yeah. That night, Amy and Natalia turned in early around 9 p.m. Amy would typically wake up around 4:30 a.m. And that night, while Sean was out, he ended up falling back into some of his old habits and took some recreational drugs. He was supposed to show up for work the next day around 7 to 8 a.m. But he did not. Amy tried to call him the next day, but he didn't answer. They were going to attempt to go to the festival again, the one that Natalia had the headache on the day they were supposed to go. They were supposed to go that afternoon, but she still hadn't heard from him. Super weird, unlike him. Later that evening, around 5:30, Sean's sister Karen stopped by his apartment to speak with him, and she had her 16-year-old son with her. When she arrived, Armand, Sean's roommate, ran outside and said, "You have to come in. Sean's been having seizures for like an hour." She found Sean on the floor, unresponsive, lying on his stomach with his feet facing the door and his head in a small pool of blood.
What?
Yeah. So she immediately calls 911. And my first thought is, he's been having seizures for an hour and there's blood and this guy hasn't called 911. But anyway, Sean did have a history of seizures. They were brought on by drug and alcohol use. He also knew when he was about to have a seizure. He would prepare for it by making a soft area to lay. Mm-hmm. But if he was standing when it happened, there's a chance he could hurt himself in a fall or something. So Karen left before the medics arrived. I'm not sure why. There were no details elaborating. Maybe she had to be somewhere, but still, you would think she
would have stayed.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there. But Sean's nephew and roommate stayed.
Uh-huh.
When the paramedics arrived, they found him breathing with a snoring sound, but his skin was super clammy. Armand claimed he did not know what was going on. He hadn't seen him in an hour. He thought he was just downstairs watching a baseball game. They turned him onto his side and tried to clear his airway, but his jaw was clenched so tightly from the seizure that they could not get his mouth open enough to get the tube in his airway. That freaks me out so much. There was some vomit on the floor mixed with blood. His underwear was also soaked in his own urine. And this is odd, but he had blood oozing from in between his toes.
What?
That is not a sign of a seizure.
No.
The other stuff, yes. Bleeding between your toes, that's weird. He also had blood between his mouth and right ear. And the paramedics thought that was unusual for a seizure. So Sean had been to Rhode Island Hospital twice before for seizures, but neither of them were this bad. His bed sheets were almost totally off the bed, which exposed the bare mattress, and there were large blood stains on it. One was around 15 inches in diameter. So pretty big, not a bloody nose.
It's like two Barbies.
Yeah, and he was found on the ground.
Yeah.
After they got Sean in the ambulance, they attempted again to put a tube into his airway, and they also thought it might be a drug overdose, so they administered Narcan, but it didn't do anything. Once he arrived to the ER, it was determined that he had a large amount of blood pooling in his brain and that it had been caused by blunt force trauma. So the location was in an unusual place for a seizure victim, and it was a major impact. The blood was almost an inch and a half thick underneath the skull.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't even know how that fits.
Where was it? Like, was it in the front, the back,
the side?
Oh, the side.
Yeah.
And that, they don't think it could have been caused from, like, falling?
Well, at that point, they weren't sure, really. Sure. They knew that's what had happened and that's what caused it. But he would need surgery because there was too much pressure on his brain. So that Saturday, he had an emergency craniectomy. And this is a type of surgery where they remove a portion of your skull to relieve the extra pressure on your brain. I didn't know what this was, so I did look it up. And after a neurosurgeon pulls back some skin from the scalp, they make holes in the skull using a special drill. Then using a power saw, the surgeon joins the holes and cuts out a piece of the skull. And the surgeon may also make a cut in the membranes that surround the brain. Then when the swelling has gone down and the bleeding's under control, they may cover the area with a mesh material.
Mm-hmm.
Then the scalp is closed with sutures or staples.
And then they have an indention in their head and they have to wear a helmet if they get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times what they will do is make an incision in the abdomen and put the skull to keep it alive inside.
Really?
And they will stitch it back up. Mm-hmm. And then once that heals and the pressure goes down, then they will remove the skull, cut the back open, reattach the skull, and then the scalp.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
When I was working in physical therapy, we had several patients that had traumatic brain injuries that we would work with. And there would be a huge indention.
Wow, I don't think I've ever seen that. Well, obviously, they'd be wearing their helmet.
But if they get out of bed at all, they have to put this helmet on, because if something hits that spot,
it's game over. There's no take backs. It can be very bad.
It's just right exposed to a brain. Yeah. That's just so wild to think about. His surgery was a success and he was stabilized, but he had brain damage at that point. At the same time, they were doing blood tests and his tox screen came back as positive for cocaine, opiates, and barbiturates. But there was a note saying that opiates and barbiturates could be explained by the hospital visit, the drugs he was administered. So he likely just did cocaine, but that we can't know for sure.
Right.
Amy had her suspicions about Sean's injury and wasn't so sure it was a result of a seizure. She also noticed Sean had other injuries. He had scratches on his chest, bruised knees, and what looked like a rug burn on his nose, forehead, and knuckles. He was also missing part of a tooth, and he had a cut in between his toes. And he did not have these injuries when Amy dropped him off at the bar the last time she saw him. Like, I mean, half a tooth. The neurosurgeon asked his family if he could have been in a fight that night because nothing was consistent with just falling. It looked like he'd been through the ringer. Now Amy, Natalia, and Sean's family, they're all suspicious. So Erin, one of Sean's sisters, went back to Armand's place and asked about the events leading up to the discovery of Sean. So Armand said, Amy dropped off Sean that Friday night and he came in by himself. So we know that's not true because she dropped him off at the
bar.
Frosty Mug. He said he worked on Saturday and that Sean had just gone to work too. Armand said that he got home and went downstairs to do some laundry, and that's when he noticed Sean lying on the floor. He didn't do anything at that point, but an hour later, he went back down and checked on him. That's when Karen, Sean's other sister, arrived and they called 911 and everything. It's like, you wait, you see someone seizing and you're waiting an hour to check on them? Why wouldn't you sit with them?
That would terrify me and I probably would call an ambulance.
How could you just not do anything? Oh, I'll check on them in an hour?
I mean, dudes.
A freaking hour? You would have to, I don't know. For some reason, Armand also took the cash that was on Sean's table and he told Erin about this. He said, oh, I grabbed some cash. I don't know why he told her. That seems weird.
I never have cash, but if I do and I'm in the middle of a seizure and you take it, I'm going to be real mad.
Exactly.
I don't care if it's $4.
So Erin was like, well, give me that cash back. That was his. Give it, just give it back to me.
What the fuck?
So he gave her 70 bucks that he got out of his bedroom. I'm like, dude's having a seizure. You're like, oh, there's some money.
I know people like this.
But he tells her about it, which is so weird.
No, they wouldn't have told me.
She wouldn't have known. So the next day, everyone received the news that Sean was in a coma and on life support.
Oh, God.
The doctor told them that he had almost no chance of ever waking up. And if he did, he would be completely brain dead. I cannot even imagine getting that kind of news and having to, you know, you're going to have to make a hard decision. Even if it's the right one, I still feel like there would be so much. You have to make the decision. It's in your hands almost, you know? It sucks.
We went through that as a family when I was in my early 20s. I had an aunt who had a heart attack. She was 42. She's my age.
Oh, my gosh.
And had two small kids. And she was on life support for 3 days because that's how long it took my uncle to say –
It would be hard. It
because
really
would.
Because
you're looking at your kids and you know you hear all these stories like they come out of it. So it's
– You never know when
never
a miracle
know.
Can happen.
Right.
And you want everyone to say their goodbyes. I would
– It's horrible, horrible to – I mean, and I know people do come out of it and miracles do happen.
Sure, yeah.
And things change, but – Any family that has gone through that knows that that is the most...
That would put such a strain.
Gut-wrenching, exhausting time. And your emotions are up and down.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make the wrong decision.
Well, right. I'm sure sometimes you're like, it's the best decision to make. And then sometimes you're like, well, what if?
Well, and then you got to think...
He has a daughter.
Right.
He has a young daughter.
If it's your spouse...
He's 34.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah.
If it's your spouse, then you're looking at like... your wife or your husband's parents, and you're like, are you going to hate me forever I mean, it's just, I can't imagine this.
I can't even imagine either. I can think that it wouldn't be something I could make right away. I would have to be like, I need
time
to just think it
and process it. And then it's like, for the rest of your life.
Yes.
It will never be the same. Oh, it's awful.
I know. His mom was ultimately the one who had to make the decision. And she
can't even imagine.
I know. She agreed to take him off life support.
Like, you're a mother. Could you? I mean, I can't even imagine.
Oh, my God.
I'd be like, you know what? We're just going to, I'll pay. We'll just keep.
Like, let's see for a week or two or a month or a year.
And that's the thing is you have just, they tell you.
I know.
Oh, it's awful.
So he passed away on Tuesday, July 25th, 2006 at 1:24 p.m. when he was 34 years old.
So young.
Like, younger than me. God.
So young.
And at this point, his apartment was not considered a crime scene. No investigation had been done. It was just like, he had a seizure, he fell. That's that. So Amy and his sister Erin go to the Frosted Mug. First, they have a beer in Sean's honor.
Mm-hmm.
Then they ask the owner if he remembered Sean coming in on Friday. And he said, yes, he did, but he didn't know when he left. Then they went to Sean's apartment. Armand met them outside with his dog. And Amy and Erin told him about Sean's passing because he didn't know at this point. Amy asked him if he had seen or heard anything Friday night. And then he said, you dropped him off. And she was surprised and clarified, no, she dropped him off at Billy's Frosted Mug at 7 p.m. on Friday, and that was the last time she had seen him. It was almost like he was trying to convince her, you dropped him off
here. Don't you remember?
Yeah, and she's absolutely not, because he keeps telling people she did. Yeah.
Not him making an alibi.
Then Armand said, well, Sean walked around the corner around 8 p.m. and had a bag of beers under his arm. We were sitting in the yard. Amy asked if anyone else was with him and asked if he went back out that night. Armand said no, he was alone, and he didn't think he went back out. Amy thought Armand seemed a little shifty. He would not look her in the eye, and he seemed nervous. She also noticed he had some cuts on his face and a Band-Aid on his finger. So sketchy. He had his dog Floyd beside him, and Floyd had a shaved patch on his tail.
The dog?
Like a clearly shaved missing part on his tail. Why would you do that? Unless blood was on it or something.
That's weird.
Yeah. Floyd was super protective of Sean, even though it was Armand's dog. And in the past, when Sean had seizures, he would bark until someone came to help. He actually spent most of his time with Sean, so Amy thought it was weird that Floyd never barked or disturbed anyone when Sean was having a seizure. Sean's mom, Ellen, stopped by that Saturday before the accident, knocked on the window, and Floyd didn't bark like he always had before. And Armand said it was because he was in the bathroom with him. He said he was scrubbing the tub like he does every Saturday. I'm like, this man scrubs a tub on a weekly basis.
I do, Lacey.
But a man.
That's
no
true.
Offense,
a man.
Listeners.
Well,
no offense.
I was going to say our friend Yancey, but no, I've bathed in his tub. He is not scrubbing it every day.
I've never even witnessed a man scrubbing a tub. Sorry, Samuel, I'm calling you out, but no. Amy and Erin needed a few of Sean's belongings, so he let them in and they went downstairs. And immediately they noticed bloodstains on the carpet near the door. On the door, on the bedroom carpet, and on the wall toward the end of the bed. There was also a bloody sheet under the comforter and a bloody loose pillowcase. Sean's body pillow had blood on it, and there were three large blood stains on the mattress.
That's a lot of fucking blood.
Especially if you just fall, and that's what knocked you out. And I mean,
so I promise I was listening because I've been asking him any questions. But so when the sister got there, was he upstairs or he was downstairs?
He was downstairs in his apartment.
Okay.
He was on the ground.
Okay. He wasn't upstairs.
No, he was on the ground and his feet were facing his door. So he was not even near his bed at this point. And they also saw a white tee with bloodstains on it, like someone wiped up blood with it. And some on the furniture. They saw blood spatter on the bottom of his bureau in his bedroom, then on his kitchen chair, the floor, and the door to the bathroom. It was literally a mess everywhere.
This is too much blood.
Blood everywhere. For having a seizure?
This is too much blood.
Yeah. So it was all over the place. And Erin took out her cell phone and took a bunch of pictures. It was in 2006, so the quality was not that great, but she still took them. They also noticed that a lamp, hammer, alarm clock, and a dumbbell set were missing.
Not a dumbbell.
Yeah, that's...
Lacey.
Yeah. And there was also a piece of paper with Armand and his nephew John's phone numbers on it, and a license plate number that belonged to Chicky. Yes, real name, which was Lynn's best friend. They couldn't make heads or tails of that. So the next day, Amy and her sister went to the police department to tell them about everything and Armand's story. Then finally, the police are like, let's seal it off as a crime scene. It's like, yeah, you think? 4 days have passed at this point. The police blame the hospital for not reporting to them that Sean was a victim of some sort of crime. Since the autopsy was already conducted, the examiner said that blunt force trauma was the cause of death. But because at that point he didn't know how the injury was sustained, he ruled the manner of death as undetermined. Mm-hmm. He did later tell the family that the skull fracture was likely from one single blow to the head. I'm thinking either the hammer or the barbell.
I hate a blunt force trauma.
Or dumbbell, I mean.
Anything.
I know. Then police got a search warrant and found blood evidence inconsistent with a fall. Shocker. They found blood spatter away from where he was discovered. Then they questioned Armand and Lynn. And since Armand was so shaken up, they allowed Lynn to write his statement for him.
No.
And he just signed it. They were together in the same room being questioned, which is crazy to me. Mm-mm. How can... So she's writing her own statement. I cannot even... I know it's a small town, but good Lord. It's 2006, not 1947. Mm-mm. So she writes her statement. She writes his statement. And he's like, yep, that's it. Sign.
That's what I said.
Unbelievable, because he's just so shaken up.
They literally beat people into confessions.
But not in Cranston, Rhode Island.
But he's like... Listen, my anxiety is all over the place.
Like, what? I'm going to outsource. Funny. He gets on Fiverr and he's like, can I find someone?
Listen.
Oh, my God. It's just.
Not him running an ad on Indeed. This is not.
These cops, what? What? Mm-mm. Even being interviewed together is problematic, mm-mm. Much less writing his statement for him. So, of course, they agreed on everything because she said what they did for both of them. When he asked about the scratches on his face, Armand and Lynn both said they were in a fight on Friday, and Lynn did the scratching. So Armand had scratches and the Band-Aid from her. They arrested Lynn for domestic violence. So Lynn had a violent past. A year and a half prior, she had been arrested for domestic violence. When she was then 45 years old, she grabbed her then-boyfriend by the throat, scratched him, and threw a large measuring cup of hot water at him. It must have been really hot. But anyway, since he was over 60, her boyfriend, this was an automatic felony.
Because it's elder abuse.
I didn't even think about that, but yeah.
Why do you think I date older men? I'm just kidding.
Don't be messy. Yeah, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. And in early 2006, Sean's daughter Natalia remembered that Lynn flipped over a table in Sean's downstairs apartment and said she was going to kill him while he was downstairs watching a game in his living room.
She's Teresa Giudice. She's flipping tables.
Mad. Yeah, and her mugshot, she just looks angry. I'm just saying. And soon after, Armand told Sean he had to move out and that Lynn was moving in. Then Armand changed his mind and said, don't worry about it. Never mind. Probably because he wanted that money to keep coming in.
Yeah.
When his sisters would visit, Lynn would make up lies and drama to them. And when they would tell Sean, like, hey, listen what Lynn said about you, and she found out she would flip out on Sean. Once she threatened to kill Sean, and it got so bad that he called the police, and he had a warrant out for failing to appear in court over something, probably a DUI or something, but he was the one arrested. So she's threatening to kill him. They go there. He gets arrested.
Jesus.
Armand broke things off with Lynn, but got right back together with her. So now back to present time of Lynn being arrested. Lynn told police that she went by Armand's place on Friday, the day before Sean was found, and that's when she and Armand got into their fight. She said she didn't spend the night, but Amy dropped Sean off around 7 p.m., again with this story that she never, it's like she's being gaslit into dropping him off there. And she's like, no, he was at the Frosted Mug.
I dropped him there and went home.
It's just wild. So she said she came back Saturday afternoon and left by 5, which was right before Karen arrived. But Charlene, another one of Sean's sisters, drove by the home at 11 a.m. on Saturday and saw Lynn's car in the driveway, meaning that she was either there earlier than she was saying or she did spend the night. Armand gave multiple different stories to police. He first said he knew about Sean's condition and took Karen inside with him to show her, which is what Karen said. Mm-hmm. But then he told the first cop on the scene that Karen went in alone and she told him that Sean was seizing, which she said is not true.
Uh-huh.
He also said Sean was watching a baseball game on TV in his bedroom on Saturday, but he didn't even have a TV in his bedroom. So just
Nothing's adding up.
Armand and Lynn did not attend Sean's funeral, and a neighbor said that people left candles and memorial writings in chalk on the pavement in front of the house, and Armand went outside and washed the chalk away. Yeah.
That's mean as fuck.
I know. They were considered people of interest, but were never arrested for Sean's murder. His case is still to this day suspended. It's not closed, but they're not actively working on it either. So when Natalia became older and became a teen, she asked the police for her father's file, but the chief wrote her back and basically said, no, it's a closed case, even though it wasn't closed. She tried diligently to get any file she could from this case, and they refused her at every single turn. Since then, she started a website called justiceforseanobrien.com, where she announced a reward of $1,000. She also has an anonymous tip line and a Facebook group for him called Justice for Sean O'Brien. She prints flyers about once a month or so and puts them on utility poles around the area, and she will not stop advocating for justice. And I will also put the numbers in our case notes or our show notes about where you can call even anonymously if you'd like, if you know anything. But I cannot believe all that blood all over the place. I don't know. Natalia's theory is they didn't want another unsolved, or they didn't want to take it to court and they not get convicted.
Right.
They just were like, oh, there's not enough to make a good case out of. We're just going to, I don't know. Like, so an unsolved, well, a suspended case is better on your records? I don't know.
I mean, you and I both are a part of that shitty club, along with Natalia, where our fathers have passed away. Mm-hmm. We know what happened to our dads.
Right.
Could you imagine if we had no clue and we thought something had I mean, obviously something happened.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like
But for the cops to be so dismissive, it's like you're not – it looks like you're trying to hide something.
That's what's so weird. And they're not even giving her information.
Why are you not trying to help me, the victim's child?
I know.
And she even contacted
the examiner that did the autopsy, and he was like, yeah, it seems like he was hit on the head by something heavy. And she contacted other detectives, other examiners, and they all agreed foul play was likely. But without the Cranston Police Department, nothing's being changed right now. It's just crazy. And of course, this happened in 2006, almost 20 years ago.
That's insane. First of all, it's insane to think 2006 being 20 years
ago. I know.
That makes me want to vomit. I know.
It seems... I know.
It seems like it
I'm
was...
I'm like, that's the 90s. I could give you 20 years is the 90s.
I could give you like 10 years, maybe. But 20? No. Oh, it's awful.
I know.
That she has no answers and she's still so... Of course she's still so...
Yeah.
Active in it. I mean, that was her daddy. She loved him. She wants closure and answers. Ugh.
I know.
I've never heard of this case.
I cannot believe. It shocks me. All that blood, you would think if there's blood all over the whole house, they're just going to be missing, like, it was a seizure.
And the missing stuff.
But I guess technically they can't prove that was missing. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
But here's the thing. Cops can't prove a lot of shit
That's
in a
true.
Lot of cases.
That's true.
And they
you
can
have wrongful convictions constantly with less
exactly.
proof. I don't know.
They can solve a case with a cigarette butt.
I know.
Oh, God.
Crazy.
I need a break.
Me too. So I'm interested about this slasher case you've got.
It's awful.
Oh, well then, I'm not excited.
So Craig Price was born in October of 1974 in Boston. When he was around 5, the entire family moved to Warwick. It had the best schools in the area. And mm-hmm. Craig had 2 older siblings. So the parents were like, we'll move here. Good schools. All the things. I get it. That's how I ended up where I'm at.
I'm just going to pray for school choice.
Listen.
I don't know.
So Craig's father was a manager for Pepsi and his mother worked at Kmart. They were normal American family, devout Baptist, dinner at the table, the whole thing. Craig played sports. He would mow his neighbor's yard. He played in the neighborhood with all the other kids, just all American family. He was a good student. He would slack off sometimes, but who doesn't? So at the age of 9, Craig said he was basically accosted by some teenage boys while riding his bike. They yelled racial slurs and pushed him off of his bike. So their family was African American.
Okay.
This was a predominantly white neighborhood that they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
This was also around the same time that his violent behavior began, and by 13, he had already had several run-ins with the law, breaking and entering, stalking, robbery, assault, and was using alcohol and marijuana daily.
Wait, how old? 13?
13.
Oh my gosh.
He then moved on to LSD.
What?
Yes. He spent 2 weeks in a juvenile detention center for burglary, so... These weren't like he skipped school crimes. These were like legit fucking crimes that he was committing.
Good Lord.
Yes. At the age of 13 is also when he killed his first victim, 27-year-old Rebecca Spencer.
Oh my God. Was he a big kid?
He was a big kid, but he was also 13. That's 3 years older than Max.
God.
Yes.
I can't even... That's...
Yes. So, Rebecca Spencer had an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. They were neighbors of Craig's. She was a single mother. She lived with her brother. And they were packing up to move to a new place. Her ex picked up the kids so her and her friend could pack up the house. Around 11:30 that night, Rebecca went to bed in the living room because the whole house had been packed up.
Mm-hmm.
Her boyfriend comes over the next morning and finds her dead. There is blood everywhere. He calls the police. She was stabbed over 58 times in her head, heart, face, lungs, all over. The case goes cold. There are no fingerprints. No one saw anything. She had no enemies. So we don't know it's Craig at this point.
Right. That seems... Crazy, though.
Yes.
Like, impossible.
Impossible. So, 2 years later, Joan Heaton, she had become a single mother after her husband tragically committed suicide in 1983. She moved her 2 little girls in the Buttonwood neighborhood where Craig lived and Rebecca lived. And they were looking for a fresh start. I mean, their family thrived here. On the morning of September the 4th, Joan's mother and sister had become very worried because they hadn't heard from her. Mm-hmm. It was Labor Day weekend. They had plans to cook out, all the things. No one heard from her. They talked every day. So mom and sister take off and drive over to her house. They go in the back door because obviously they have a key, their family, and they see blood all over the floor. They find 8-year-old Melissa in the kitchen, 39-year-old Joan in the hallway covered in a sheet, and 10-year-old Jennifer by her mother. Police arrive, and Joan had been stabbed 60 times and strangled. Melissa was stabbed multiple times with the knife broken in her neck, and her skull had been crushed by a kitchen stool. And Jennifer was stabbed 62 times. She was stabbed. And we've talked about this before. To stab somebody that many times, like, this is rage.
Well, and killing multiple people.
And a child, an 8-year-old's little body. It's just, it's awful. So there are no fingerprints, even though nearly every knife in the house was used.
Oh, my God.
Yes. No neighbors heard or seen anything. They did find a size 13 sock covered in blood, which I don't know how they would know what size a sock is, but
yeah, that's
it was what a I was large, thinking. Large sock.
A big sock, yes. Yeah.
So the FBI is called in, and this is what they think happened, judging what they see. The intruder climbed through the window onto the kitchen table. It broke. Joan hears it, walks downstairs to see what's going on. He attacks her. Two little girls hear it. They come down. Then he attacks and kills them. So the FBI creates a profile. They say it's someone local to the neighborhood. They probably knew them, knew their routine, knew that she was single and there wasn't a man in the house. Probably late teens, early 20s, and a white man, which is mostly what's in the neighborhood. Someone who had had past run-ins with the law and also lived within walking distance because nobody's seen a vehicle.
Okay.
And they most likely injured themselves. While just they
because
were,
it, yeah, I
because
mean,
of all the stabbing. So the neighborhood goes nuts. They're buying guns.
Oh my God.
They're doing neighborhood watch. They are buying guard dogs. This is the second stabbing.
If that was happening in my neighborhood,
terrifying.
Especially stabbing. Oh my God.
Brutal stabbings. Two women, two little girls. Within years, very few years, 2 years of each other. So a few days later, detectives see Craig. He doesn't really match the description, but they know him because he's had run-ins with the law, and they think maybe he knows something. He walks over to the police, tells them he's heard this, he's heard that, all the things, and they notice that he has a cut on his hand. He's 15 at this point.
Just 15. He's 15.
This is just 2 years after Rebecca's murder. So they're like, what happened? He says, oh, I got drunk and punched the window of a car over on Keeley Road. Cops aside, we're going to drive over there.
Good Lord.
See if we see anything. There's no car, no broken glass anywhere, no reports of vandalism either. So he has just become a suspect. Because not only has he had run-ins of the law, but he lives very closely to Joan, and he also lived very closely to Rebecca, and that case is still unsolved, and these two were very similar in the stabbing. So they go to his house. They ask him to come down to the station with his parents, and he agrees. He takes a polygraph test. There are some discrepancies, but he can leave. They notice that he wears a size 13 shoe. Like, he's got a big foot. He's a big 15-year-old. He's almost 300 pounds and 6 foot tall.
Okay, I was thinking, so like, he has to be if he's overpowering. I know they're children, too, but multiple people.
He's
you know
a
what
big,
I mean?
Big boy.
Oh, God.
So the police question the neighbors about Craig, his friends from school. They tell the police that Craig, he bragged about killing Rebecca Spencer.
What?
But he was such a jokester that they thought he was just being insincere. And they jokingly called him the Buttonwoods killer or the Buttonwoods slasher. Police get a warrant. They search his house. They find nothing. He's asleep on the couch. He's not even bothered by them being there. They go to the shed in the backyard and they search it. In the very back, they find a bag of bloody clothes and bloody knives that were used in the murder of Joan and her two little girls. He is arrested and brought down to the station, and his parents are with him, and he confesses to everything. He was very calm. He told all the details of how he did it. His father couldn't take it. He walked out of the room. His mom sat there and bawled hysterically. I mean, that's her son, and he's just admitted to brutally murdering two women and two little girls. He said he went to Jones to rob her. Same thing with Rebecca. He went, originally with Rebecca, he had went into the house but left and then came back later to murder her. He told them that his bloody clothes from the night he murdered her were hidden in the attic. Police go back to the house, and sure enough, they find him. But he still hasn't told them why. So finally, he says he was playing outside with some kids on the street when he was 13. A car pulled up, yelled at them and at him some racial slurs, and it was Rebecca's boyfriend. So he watched where the car went and parked, and he wanted revenge because he didn't stand up for himself when it happened. Rebecca's boyfriend denied this, and the friends that were with him that day were questioned, and they said he yelled at us to get out of the road so we could drive by, but never any racial slurs. So later that night, when everyone was asleep, he snuck out of his house and into hers quietly, grabbed a kitchen knife, watched her sleep for a while, then stabbed her 58 times. He said he met the Heaton family while he was riding bikes. He offered to fix the little girl's bike chain one day, and the two little girls started giggling to one another, and he said he knew that was racially motivated. Probably not. They're 8 and 10. They giggle at everything. That's what little girls do. Anyways, he said he saw Joan staring at him through the window, and it was because he was a young black man, so he had to murder them all. She was probably staring at you because she was watching her two girls, not because you were a man, but I watched Max out the window and who he's talking to and what's going on. It doesn't matter.
Right, yeah.
You're going to keep an eye on your kids to two little girls.
A teen talking to two kids, yeah.
So none of his friends believed he could do this. He's 15.
I wouldn't have thought that either. Right. I mean, even though he's bigger.
So they showed up at the police department. They supported him. Mm-hmm. There was no trial because he was underage. He pled guilty to all four murders and was sentenced to a detention center in a juvenile facility until he was 21. That was the max that the judge could give him. And once he turned 21, he would be released and the records would be sealed, which makes you go, how many people do we meet that have had some bullshit happen and we don't know because their records are sealed? So, of course, the public is furious about all of this. Yeah. It doesn't seem like justice has been served at all. I couldn't imagine if this were my sister and her children being murdered like this. And they're like, well, he's going to do 5 years, 6 years, and then he's going to be released.
That's scary.
It's insane.
The overkill is scary. Yes. I mean, all of it is.
It's like rage.
It's not like, I mean, it's all bad, but like if you were breaking into a house and he saw someone pointing a gun at him and he shot back, even though that's still the wrong thing to do and terrible, it's, I don't know, just the whole overkill and stabbing, it's, oh, God.
To the point where you break a knife off and take a bar stool and crush an 8-year-old skull.
Like, still, I'm thinking, it's 15 years old, how do you do that? How is that possible?
So psychiatrists report a pre-existing paranoia trait that caused him to perceive mistreatment when non-existent.
Okay.
He believed he was singled out due to his race, even though it wasn't true. And he used racism as his reasoning behind the murders. The racism he did experience, though, was with men, and he murdered 4 women. 2 women and 2 little girls. So that doesn't make... Yeah. It's not like he was going after men.
Well, and the first one, it was her boyfriend that he alleged. Yeah, it wasn't her. Yeah. So
the Rhode Island state attorney started a campaign to change the law so that juveniles could be charged as adults depending on the severity of the crime. Mm-hmm. The families of the victims and the police detectives also joined in this campaign, and the law was passed in 2007, but does not apply to any crime committed before it was passed. So it did not apply to this case. So part of his sentence he had was to be seen by 2 different psychiatrists. They wanted intensive treatment and diagnosis to see what caused him to commit such a rageful, awful crime. And this had to be done before he could be released back into society. Like, that was part of the stipulation. Right. That was part of the what he was sentenced to. So Dr. Sherbert Frazier, a former director of National Institute of Mental Health, and Dr. Wesley Prophet, who was the director of forensic services at Bridgewater State Hospital, were assigned his case. Sidebar, both of these names sound made up.
I was about to say, a big fan of your ice cream.
Yes, Dr. Sherbert and Dr. Prophet. So he agreed to cooperate, Craig did, but once they told him he would have to relive those moments, he refused. He thought they were trying to trick him, and if he told it again, then they would commit him to a mental institution once he was set to be released. So they go back to court, and the judge says, basically, this isn't an option. You don't have a choice. Like, if you don't do this, you're not going to be released. This is part of your sentencing. Dr. Prophet also testified that if he did not do this, he would be a danger to society. But he still refused. Dr. Prophet went on to make a statement basically saying, this guy's bad news, and I believe he will repeat these actions if released without being rehabilitated or having treatment. So he's basically the guy from Halloween that's like, you can't release Michael.
Yeah.
Because he will fuck everybody up if he comes out. So Craig's still refusing, and now he's 20. The judge was asked to hold him in contempt of court for not complying, and in June of 94, the judge charged him with contempt and sentenced him to another year. This time he was sent to an adult prison. A month later, he met with a psychiatrist, but the doctor said he was lying about everything he told him. His story changed multiple times. Then the judge charged him with criminal contempt, and he was sentenced to another 25 years.
That escalated.
Yes. This judge was not fucking around. Like, you have been told, and you've jerked us along. And these are awful, horrendous crimes. Like, we're not going to ask you again. You've been warned. You didn't take it serious. So now you have 25 years. 10 years to be served in prison, and then probation for 15.
Man.
Craig says to this day that his sentence was increased because he was black. Craig is still in prison. He was charged with extortion and assault in 1994 for threatening a training school employee. He claimed everyone was lying and that they were all racist. He was sentenced to 15 years. 8 would be served in prison. But he keeps getting into trouble. In 96, he bit a correctional officer's hand, and another year was added to his sentence. In 1998, he assaulted an officer and had 7 more years added to his sentence. From 99 to 2001, more violence ensued, and he had 4 more years added to his sentence. And in 2004, he was transferred to Florida because it was too dangerous for him to be in general population because his fucking rage was out of control.
That's scary.
2009, he stabbed another prisoner with a shank while the guy was trying to break up a fight that Craig was in. He was charged with assault and possession of contraband, adding another 2.5 years to his sentence, plus 60 days of solitary. In 2017, he attacked another inmate and stabbed him 5 times before guards could intervene. December 15th of 2019 was his original release date. On January 18th of 2019, he was sentenced to another 25 years for the attack on the inmate in 2017. So he's not going anywhere. He's still in prison.
Can't stop getting out of trouble.
It makes you go, what the fuck happened? What happened?
His parents were together, yes. Obviously, when this first thing happened. Was he abused?
Not that anybody has said anything that I found, any research I've done. Nothing has said he was ever abused, ever mistreated. Nothing. It's almost like he has something going on mentally. And I'm not saying that derogatory, but it's like he's got some kind of, but he wouldn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
He refused, which is why he got 25 years added. And then he just raged against everybody. I feel like something had to happen. Of course, we're speculating. We don't know, but those poor women and little girls, completely senseless. And we've said it before, but these cases are the worst of the worst when there's no motive.
It's scary.
He claimed there was a motive, but these women had no idea that someone was laying in wait to viciously murder them. It's awful. And those little girls, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know, they knew what was happening. 10?
Yeah. And I'm not playing devil's advocate exactly, but like, even if the boyfriend had said something to him, maybe he did. Who knows? Maybe he did. Why kill her over?
Stab her 58 times in her face and chest.
Oh, God.
Rhode Island.
That's a rough one.
I mean, anyways.
Oh, my God.
Do you have anything good to tell us before I dive into 72 million things that I have to talk about?
I do. And sorry again for the segue. We have a new patron.
Awesome.
Audrey C. from Florida. Sunny Florida.
Did you put her thing in?
Not yet.
Boo.
I don't know where the city is, but I'll find it.
It's okay.
My map only has big cities, well, big-ish cities, so I have to Google it. It takes a minute. I'm like, where the hell is this? But thank you, Audrey. We appreciate it. That's the good news. What's your good news?
Well, I don't have any good news, but there is so much fabulous going on in the news right now. What in the world? As my grandma used to say, we're living in the end of days.
Oh, my.
We're living in the end of days.
Oh, tell me about
it. For real, though. First of all, Riley Strain has been found. The college kid.
Yes.
That disappeared after leaving the bar in Nashville.
That video of him walking. Oh, man.
So, that's the University of Missouri student who went missing after leaving a downtown Nashville bar. He was found in the Cumberland River. No signs of foul play. He was 22. On a weekend trip, was kicked out of Luke's 32 Bridge, which we've been to.
Mm-hmm.
His friends and family were unable to reach him. Police searched. They couldn't find him. And Metro Police Chief John Drake said that his body was found after being spotted by a worker.
Oh.
No evidence suggests anything other than he just fell in the river. The body was discovered about 8 miles from downtown. It seems like it would have went further in 2 weeks. Maybe that's just me not knowing how the currents go.
Yeah, maybe stuck. I don't know.
He says, we have reports that normally under these circumstances with his weight and height that if he did fall in and drown, that he would surface between 14 and 20 days. And on the 14th day is when they found him.
They can predict that?
Yes. I didn't know. And of course, the bartender said he had been overserved and he was paying his tab when he was kicked out. His bank card was found on an embankment by the river. So the bar released a statement saying that he was overserved, but they say they only served him one drink and two waters. So I mean, either he was roofied or he was shit-faced when he got there to begin with. Yeah, so,
and that could have been the case.
Very well could have. We're just speculating. It's fucking horrible. He was kicked out of this bar and his friends, you know, I've seen conflicting things where one thing said the friends tried to go and were stopped and others said it, they didn't try to go. I mean, if you got kicked out because you were too drunk, I'm going to be pissed, but I'm going to go with you.
Right.
Not just because you're a woman, but we've experienced that with our male friends. Like, they got to go.
It's time for us to go.
And we leave and we make sure they go home and they're safely. No shade at anybody, but. It's a horrible tragedy. I can't.
When I saw that video of him walking downtown, there's just something I just knew it was not going to be good.
No, it's awful.
Just tell he wasn't, man.
Also, I know this is all a week behind, so more and more shit's going to come out, but P. Diddy.
Yeah.
Baby, what the actual fuck?
I'm out of the loop on P. Diddy.
I'll 3x5 okay, it, but good. This is going to be real fucking bad. There's so much coming out, and it's hard to tell what is real. And who's being honest and who's cashing in on their 10 minutes. And from what I've seen on my TikTok deep dive.
I have not been on Diddy Talk.
It's just disgusting. Oh. So authorities searched his home on Monday because he is a target of a federal investigation carried out by the Department of Homeland Security that handles human trafficking. According to the senior federal law enforcement official, the probe was led by U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York and carried out by the Department of Homeland Security Investigations. It is responsible for investigating transnational crimes and threats. Transnational. Yes.
What in the world?
So, including human trafficking, terrorism, narcotic smuggling, and other organized criminal activities. The investigation stems from many of the same sexual assault allegations put forth in several civil lawsuits against him.
Man.
Yes. He has denied, obviously, all allegations. So heavily armed teams of HSI agents searched homes in LA and Miami on Monday, riding in armored vehicles. Partly because authorities believe that Puff Daddy employs armed private security at each of his residences, a source says. Agents were authorized to search for documents, phones, computers, and all electronic devices that hold data or videos, the second law enforcement source told the news. So Monday searches were related to an ongoing sex trafficking investigation. He's been accused of sexual misconduct in 5 separate lawsuits in the last couple months. In November, the singer Cassie filed a lawsuit against Combs, her former boyfriend, in federal court in New York. The suit alleged he raped her, forced her to engage in sex trafficking, and subjected her to years of abuse. A week later, Joy Dickerson Neal filed a suit in New York accusing him of drugging and sexually assaulting her in 1991. She also alleged she was a victim of revenge porn from him. And in December, an anonymous woman referred to as Jane Doe filed a lawsuit accusing Combs of sex trafficking and gang raping her in 2003 when she was 17.
Oh my God. I had no idea it was this bad.
Girl, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what I read because we'd be here all night.
Oh my God.
You can actually see the case, like the affidavit that was signed against him from a male who is also a up-and-coming artist, and a lot of names have been redacted, but he has photos, videos of celebrities, and I will tell you off the air, I'm not going to tell you on here, you can TikTok it, Google it, YouTube, whatever you want, But these are famous people that this man has videos of doing these things with people, with underage people involved in all this shit. I'm telling you, it's going to get really fucking bad. It is insane, Lacey. It's insane. It makes me want to throw up.
Oh, my God.
It's insane.
I just have been, as you've been speaking, looking up P. Diddy, and he's a billionaire. Like, the thought, I mean, I know people do it no matter what, but if you have that much money and that much fame, why do you have to do stuff like
that? Because you think you're invincible, and if you can do it, why not fucking do it? You're going to get away with it.
It's like,
the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
What a mess.
It's a mess. It's a mess. It really is.
And he has several children.
Yes. And whenever all this took place, he was getting on a plane with his twin teenage girls to go to spring break.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yes. So more and more of this is going to come out. This is not the first or last. Well, this is the first, but it won't be the last time we talk about this. But it's in fucking sane. So put a pin in that. Moving on. Kate Middleton.
Oh, man.
I mean, Lord, girl, she has cancer. We don't know what kind. It doesn't fucking matter. It's sad and it's scary for anyone. Yeah. Anytime, any place, and any kind of cancer. It's horrible. It's scary. It's terrifying. On March 22nd, she revealed in a video that she has cancer and is undergoing treatment. Kensington Palace spokesperson said, "We're not sharing any further personal medical information," which, good for them. She has a right to her privacy.
Yeah.
Just like we all do. They originally thought that the abdominal surgery she was having was non-cancerous, but it turned out to be cancerous. And they're not going to provide any more details about her surgery. So, I mean, it's awful and we're sending good vibes. Spokesman for Kate said that she started chemotherapy in late February and it's just terrible. She says she will return to official duties when she's cleared to do so by her medical team. Mm-hmm. She's in good spirits. Not what a lot of people thought, but at least we know we have some answers. We know she's not all the things that people were saying and the speculations.
But the palace, their PR team or whatever, put it out that Kate is editing her own photos.
This is true.
That really irritates me. They're the ones that started fanning the flames by doing that. And then they blame Kate, the one with cancer.
Sure. It's just, that's we don't scummy. Love that. That's, we don't, it's very sad. Like I said, we're sending positive vibes, prayers, whatever you believe in. We're doing it. That's terrible.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was down the rabbit hole too. I'm like, what in the world's happening?
Everyone was, because they were so tight-lipped. And I mean, we get it that they probably weren't sure what to say or how to say it, considering King Charles just revealed that he had cancer also. But you know what? Here's the thing about cancer. They don't give a fuck. Yeah. They don't care if you're famous or you're poor or you live in Arkansas or you live in Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
It's awful for everyone it affects. Mm-hmm. So anyways, in other news, have you seen her new private secretary that she hired?
No.
Girl. What? Lieutenant Colonel Tom White. You know I'm going to find a hot dude no matter what.
No, I haven't seen him.
I mean, he's easy on the eyes. I'm just telling you. It's giving bodyguard vibes. I'll just tell you that.
Okay, Whitney.
Insert hard eye emoji here. Okay. You need to Google this picture. Put your wine glass down. Lacey's drinking, everybody. So if this
I'm drinking wine for the first time in, what's 9 plus 4?
13
months.
So if this episode is long and strangely familiar to our old stuff, it's because Lacey's drinking. Go ahead and give Lieutenant Colonel Tom White a little goog, because he's hot.
God, spelling lieutenant is just never going to work out for me. Look.
Just put Tom White. Do, do, do. Go to images.
He looks very British.
He looks like his mouth is shut, so he could have bad teeth. I don't know, but he's cute.
His mouth's open.
Let me see. I mean, I would not be opposed to anything that he wanted to protect me from. Oh my God. Anyways, so a very special friend shared his password to his Shudder account after I talked about it. I know
exactly who you're talking about. And you know what? I could talk to him for a long time about some scary movies.
You know who you are at Curly Boy, but because I wanted to watch Late Night with the Devil.
Yes.
It doesn't come out until April.
Oh.
So I watched some other bullshit on there, but it was good. I did watch Elevator.
Is it worth getting?
No.
Shudder isn't?
No.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Curly Boy. I'm going to give Lacey your password.
I don't know the nickname.
I'm going to give Lacey your password. But I watched Elevator.
Okay. Is that the one where they're all trapped in an elevator and one's the devil?
Or maybe that's devil. Oh, okay. Your wine glass.
That is a movie, though. It is, and they're one in is the devil and they're in the elevator.
Okay, yeah. Okay, okay. No, this one's kind of a thriller, and somebody has a bomb, and it's good. You should watch it. Mm. I'm sharing it here. No one asked. 1 week until apocalypse.
I'm like, what?
Do you have your stuff ready?
What do you mean by stuff?
Your glasses.
I have my glasses.
Your cash.
Samuel bought
your car filled up.
Well, I'm not leaving.
Well.
I'm not going anywhere.
The anxiety is building. There's a billboard on the way to work that has a countdown clock on it.
Really?
I saw it this morning. And I have so many questions. I'm like, can we take pictures? Is it safe for us to take pictures? Do we need these glasses on at all times? Like, what's going to happen? Are these stupid questions? Should I know this stuff?
No. I mean, I don't know this stuff, but also a lot of people are freaking out because it's supposed to, well, I mean, I know it's weeks away, be cloudy. And
well, according
people
to
people are coming from freaking England and Beverly Hills.
According to our local news weather anchor, I'm not going to say his name because this isn't an ad. He said he's feeling good about the cloud coverage not being to where we can't see it.
Okay.
He's like, it's not going to disrupt it.
Okay.
Yeah. His nickname is the Yak.
I was about to say it's the Yak Man.
It's the Yak Man. Yes.
Okay. You speak of.
There are a lot of things going on in and around Little Rock. The can go to ardot.gov for road condition plans and arkansas.com for a list of all eclipse events scheduled. So I'm just going to give you this little bit of information. The path of totality is going to stretch over 100 miles across Arkansas from the southwest to the northeast. And in some locations, you're going to get over 4 minutes of totality. Which
I'm ready for the bugs to be like thinking it's nighttime and
no, the fucking locusts are coming out, Lacey.
Tree flogs. Yes, remember? The locusts.
Mm-hmm. So counties and cities in Arkansas, 53 of Arkansas' 75 counties will fall in the path of totality, which include Little Rock, Hot Springs, Texarkana, Conway, and Jonesboro. So they expect up to 1.5 million people to travel from outside the state, along with 500,000 Arkansans who will travel from their residences to the path of totality for a total of 2 million people.
I'm not leaving. I'm having a totality pool party.
Listen, approximately.
BYO baby.
So approximately 700,000 extra vehicles are what they're expecting on the road.
Well, welcome to pothole land,
listen,
folks.
Listen, you better have a spare. So they're saying 30% of sightseers are going to arrive the day of the event, and 80% of them will leave immediately after it's over with. So it's just going to be like, we're here, we see it, we're turning around, we're going home.
It just blows my mind that people care this much. No offense if you do.
I wouldn't travel somewhere to see it.
I would never. If I wouldn't even go an hour away.
If this was in Detroit, I'm not going.
Like, I just live here and I'll walk outside, sure, and see it. But like,
in Dallas, I'm not going.
No.
I'm just not. So,
don't want to yuck a yum.
Right. No.
If Taylor Swift was on the eclipse, Jesus, I'd be like, Christ. Give me my glasses. Give me my glasses.
Give me my bike since traffic's going to be backed up. Hop on my back. Onders.
Scooters.
So anyways, yeah, people are getting real excited about it.
We're going to have a festival on Main Street over here.
There's going to be so much.
There's going to be booths and this and that.
You're so lucky you don't have to drive. I'm
trotting over there with my baby Bjorn.
And here's the thing. My niece, Remy, her first birthday party is Saturday. And she lives about an hour and a half away, like going towards Memphis. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, I'm supposed to be in Hot Springs. So, because we're going to go to the lake house and kind of post up. And I'm having mixed emotions about missing her first birthday versus fighting all that fucking traffic.
Yeah, that's going to be a crazy time to have a birthday.
So I'm thinking, is it inappropriate for me to text my niece-in-law and be like, listen, we got to change, your daughter's first birthday. I mean, yeah, I don't feel, and we couldn't
it's
do
not
it
a good travel day.
Couldn't do it this weekend because it's Easter. Mm-hmm. But then next weekend, I'm like, listen, this is the total eclipse.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a good time for people to be on 40. Like, 40 sucks anyways.
It's already bad.
Yeah.
It's
potholes and semis. Ugh. Anyways, next week, Nebraska.
Oh, boy, the Cornhusker State.
And then we're just three episodes after that till we finish season three. Wow. That's two or three states. And maybe it's four, because maybe also it's the Patreon.
Yeah.
And then we're taking just a wee break.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back.
Your girls need it.
Girls need Lacey needs it. Anyways, goodbye.
Bye.